You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, June 30th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. On the program today, Caroline Frederickson, president of the American Constitutional Society and author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Also on the program today, President Obama sort of announces in a HuffPost piece that we are days away from the unveiling of his executive action asking the Labor Department to raise the threshold as to who is eligible for overtime work. It's not as high as we wanted. Also on the program today, the Supreme Court takes a case to attack union agency fees, public unions. That'll come down in 2016, but this could be a serious death blow to unions. Meanwhile, Chris Christie has jumped into the race, folks. Yes. Chris Christie bringing up the rear guard. I don't think he's last in the polls, but I do think he's in the teens. And by teens, I mean he's not polling in the teens. He's in like around number 14 or 15 in the Republican race. It's going to be like a 14th place, 13th place. Also on the program today, ladies and gentlemen, you may not be able to see the Miss Universe pageant. And you won't be able to see Donald Trump on The Apprentice any longer. However, what you will see is a lot of crying Republicans. I was on Chris Hayes' program last night. For the life of me, in a million years, I don't have the decoder ring or the safe-cracking ability to find video on MSNBC's site. But I will talk about an exchange I had with Michael Steele. It really is worth watching, but we don't, or listening to. We don't have access to it. I sort of no longer record when I appear on television unless it's something really special, like being on the Marin show. But that exchange, I think, is really indicative. It is hilarious to me. I mean, honestly, hilarious to see how the Republicans are freaking out about Donald Trump. And they should be. And they should be. Make no mistake about it. They should be. We're seeing something happen on the Democratic side. Not quite the same. But there is that sort of low rumblings of not panic yet. But Bernie Sanders is really doing well. And contrary to the expectations of the Beltway elite, he is doing very well. So we will look into that as well. And of course, there is huge anti-marriage backlash on the right. Ted Cruz has really been whining quite a bit. There's there's a huge part of the Republican Party that's just become a, like a massive winery now. And a couple of those backwater states which are refusing to follow the laws of this country, I don't know where they're gonna end up with that. But it's fun to watch. Look, I've said this many times before. A dinosaur wags its tail 20 minutes after its head's cut off. Now, I don't know if it's 20 minutes. While it is the case that many of these places which are denying people the right to marriage equality, they would know more about dinosaurs, since in those places, men and dinosaurs lived at the same time in our planet. That's what I've been told. I think it also happens to a chicken, but I don't know, a chicken doesn't really have a tail. Like when their head's lopped off, they still run around quite a bit. That's what we're seeing now in terms of this ideology. But we're going to take a break and talk to Caroline Fredrickson, I should say. Just wanted to let you know that this program relies on your support. If you have the financial means, please support the program by becoming a member. If you do not have the financial means and you would like the bonus part of the show, just send us an email at Majority Reporters. We do that all the time for people. There is no reason. You would be amazed. You know, people write us and they have sometimes people say they're embarrassed about it, whatnot. Let me just tell you, you would be amazed at how many people at different times have had problems, financial troubles. And then the good news is 6 months later, 9 months later, a year later, we get an email. I found a job, or my husband is healthier now, or whatever it is. And so people bounce back. So please don't hesitate. It is very gratifying for us when the show can be, something that people can enjoy during a time where they're under some type of stress. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Caroline Fredrickson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Caroline Fredrickson. She is the president of the American Constitutional Society. She is a former aide to Senator Tom Daschle, and she is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Sam, thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on a great show like this.
Oh, well, thank you. And I mentioned that you were a former aide to Senator Tom Daschle because the some of the most interesting stuff to me in your book, which in some respects can be a little bit enraging, frankly.
That's but, the idea.
but some of what is most interesting to me is to see the history of how some of the most important legislation that we have in this country in terms of protecting workers' rights was written and developed with a lot of exemptions and exclusions that were not sort of a patchwork or happenstance, but were very deliberate and then become the foundation for exemptions that are similar, that people don't necessarily understand what the genesis of those exemptions were.
Well, that's exactly right. And so, Sam, what's really interesting to me was that as I was researching under the bus, I started looking into, the sort of the creation at the beginning of the, very important legislation during the New Deal, which established the right to a minimum wage and overtime, which gave workers the right to organize, and even the Social Security law. And in looking at them, and the Social Security law has had some fixes since then, but I was just floored to see not only the very, very explicit racism and misogyny that members of Congress expressed in the record, which I guess isn't that surprising considering the time, but it's still shocking from a current point of view. And in doing so, what they were saying was, here's why these exemptions exist, because we really, the Southerners, it was essentially Southerners protecting what was still the legacy of slavery, the continuing exploitation of African American, many of them women, on the still existing plantations in the sort of the old South style of sharecropping, and the women who took care of everything in the household, the children, the cleaning, the cooking, you name it. And so what they were essentially saying was, our former slaves who are now, barely treated better than that, if at all, we want to keep them in the same impoverished circumstances with just as few rights. And that is just what happened. And so then what we did was, and those laws, I don't want to sound like they were bad. They benefited a lot of people. But there were certainly groups that got left out. What we didn't do is go back and fix that later on. There have been some efforts, but it has been a real uphill battle. And as you mentioned, I worked for Senator Tom Daschle. I helped to draft a bill called the Paycheck Fairness Act. Well, the Paycheck Fairness Act is an update of one of these former laws. Just like we've grafted on, Title VII has the legislation protecting against disability discrimination, was building on the legislation that protected against race and gender and religious discrimination. And so when we update them and we add something new, we haven't gone back and looked at the fundamentals and said, well, what could be changed about the original? And so, it's like the Equal Pay Act, which was adopted in the 60s. It deals with gender disparities in pay, but it was built on the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that's the legislation that establishes the minimum wage and overtime. So guess what? It doesn't apply to the same workers that aren't protected in that category for minimum wage and overtime. So it's like a double disadvantage for, and these were primarily domestic workers, farm workers. There's a whole category. Originally, there were laundry workers. You know why that one was there.
Well, let's,
taxi drivers.
I want to dig into this because I don't know. I don't know if people necessarily do know. I mean, because I think, at that time, it's important to remind people, who the people were that fulfilling these roles at that time. When you talk about agrarian workers, this again, and it's fascinating because a lot of what you write is literally pegged to what's going on, to a lot of discussions that are going on over the past couple of weeks. I mean, people are beginning to understand that, when they see the Confederate flag, this was, I think, I just don't think there's as much awareness out there as some people think there is of an understanding of, to the extent that the economic interest had anything to do with the Civil War, it was economic interest in maintaining free labor by slaves.
Exactly. No, it's very true, and I think it's very important what you pointed out, and I've thought about that a lot in the discussion around the flag, and what's happened is that we have these things. They're not just symbols. They're actually real live evidence of the damage that slavery and Jim Crow have done to our country, and then we have this legacy that is similar in our laws. And so, it's quite illuminating in many ways because the people who are farm workers and domestic workers now are still people of color. They are still impoverished. Domestic workers are 90% women. A large percentage of farm workers are women, not the majority necessarily, but there are many more than people think. They've changed somewhat in who they are, and domestic workers many of them are immigrant women, many are not native English speakers. But what's happened really, which makes it even sort of more necessary in many ways to fix this than ever before, is that the numbers are growing. Because we have an aging population, and as a result, the business interests around home health care have really made a mint off of providing services to elderly and disabled people, they've been very successful at beating back efforts to put domestic workers under the minimum wage and overtime laws. And I have to say to your listeners, people do not understand how so many of these domestic workers, they're taking care of our people who are most important to us. They're either our children, our parents, close relatives. They often make less than the minimum wage, and they're working often over 80 hours a week. It's just, and they don't get overtime. So it's really, really an incredibly exploitative industry. And I'm happy to say the Obama administration has been trying to actually fix that, but it hasn't happened yet because the industry is suing to prevent the new rules from going into place.
Is this the overtime rules?
Well, this is a different set of overtime rules. Happily, the Department of Labor is moving forward with one piece. It's the salary basis test, which lifts an incredibly low level. It was really barely tinkered with since 1975, which we could talk about that.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute. I just want to make sure I understood which set of labor laws you were talking
what
about.
What happened? So, as I said, in the Jim Crow era, when the Dixiecrats, the racists in the South, and there were plenty of racists in the North too, but in their efforts to protect, still near slave labor situation, they exempted these workers from minimum wage and overtime. So the domestic workers have fought really hard, and they almost got an increase or got put under the protection of the law under the Clinton administration. And now President Obama is moving forward with a regulation that would address the issue. And as I, it's not to get into too much detail, but the interesting part of doing my research and under the bus is I see how sort of this goes in waves. The workers were actually successful in the 70s in actually getting put into the law, but the Nixon Department of Labor issued a regulation that cut them right out again, and that regulation is what's at issue right now. So they're now covered by the law theoretically, but the regulation excludes them. President Clinton tried to fix it. Now President Obama is trying to fix it. It is,
Let's get into. The one fantastic thing about this program and this audience is that they have no compunction about getting very deep into the weeds, because this type of stuff, I think, is really. And what I found so fascinating about what you were writing was that this stuff gets stuck in there, and it's just sort of left there, and it becomes sort of an assumption that people don't question, and these assumptions have existed for 70 some odd years plus, starting with that with the National Labor Standards Act. And so let me ask you this first question: when that horse trading to get this legislation is passed, I mean, I think this audience is aware that Social Security left out, largely speaking, African Americans as a way of like getting it sold to people. But is it a function of it is sort of like a, how much of it is racism versus, let's say, a de facto racism versus, say, this is a completely unrepresented group of the population because of where they are from a class standpoint, and so nobody's going to protect their interest. Versus these things aren't necessarily in opposition to each other, of course, but I guess distinct from this is such a key component of our economy in a certain region of the country. In other words, that we've always we built our these industries on free labor, and now we have expanded them on near free labor, and so we're really entrenched here. Is it possible to parse those different things?
It's a great question. I think the historical legacy is clearly racism and misogyny, and you see that. But it was economic too, because what the Southerners were protecting was, as I said, it was they were paying slave wages. I mean, what they were trying to protect was their ability to exploit workers. I mean, they did it out of racist ideology, but it was certainly also a bottom line interest that they didn't want to pay them. And so, you know, what I think has happened is, though, that the racist element, we don't revive that in the conversation about why these exemptions exist. We just write laws that build on the old ones, and we don't erase them. And you know, as I said, with the domestic workers, when there was a, you know, was a big effort to get them put under the law that is still being fought, there's now a huge industry that has built up around the exploitation of these workers. I mean, these are big, big companies. They're multi-million-dollar interest now in the United States trying to, you know, provide care for elderly people, and their model is one that's built on labor that's paid less than the minimum wage in many circumstances. And so I think, you know, it's the mix of those two things that sort of the original piece was maybe more racist and misogynistic, but now there's an industry in place that wants to keep it that way desperately. And they're not, and these groups don't have a lot of leverage. My book was just trying to, in Under the Bus, I was trying to point out to people how widespread these exemptions are, how many people are affected, how these are growing industries, but also to look at some of the other issues that affect what are primarily, you know, sort of seen as women's issues, child care, family leave, you know, part-time work schedules and so forth. But actually, for me, what I wanted, the point I want to make in Under the Bus is these are actually issues of economic justice. And in the world that we live in today, women work. Women with very small children, three-quarters of them work. That's not going to change. And so whether you like it or not, we have to address it. You know, whether we care about whether it's women who have the ability to actually earn a decent living and be out in the workforce if they want to be, or their children who need to have proper care, who need to have a parent who can earn a decent wage, who can pay for child care. So those are, you know, I think that's where I, you know, one of the main points of this book was that economic justice is essentially, when we talk about issues that affect women in the workplace, we've got to stop separating it out and thinking of them as women's issues, and sort of child care is like a frivolous interest that allows women to kind of spend a little time outside of the house as if it's not an economic necessity. And so that's, you know, that's what I was doing. And, you know, one of the things that was really striking to me, and maybe it would be for a lot of your listeners if they were thinking about their own family, but I spend a little time researching my family. My mother is an immigrant, very recent immigrant, but on my father's side, they came from Sweden at the end of the 19th century, and my great-grandmother, Matilda Olofsson, was, you know, sort of a teen. She came by herself, very, very poor family in Sweden, was basically sent off because they couldn't take care of her anymore. They couldn't feed her. She came to Boston on her own. No English. She worked as a scullery maid. And I, you know, I just thought that was like a world of, you know, of ancient history. It was, you know, when I was a kid, I watched Upstairs, Downstairs. It seemed like, wow, it's just, you know, it's so long ago. And then as I did the research for Under the Bus, I found women like Sonia Suarez, who works in Boston now, who is a domestic worker and has the same set of incredibly difficult circumstances. She has no legal protection. She suffers from sexual harassment. She's worked 14-hour days. Her employers don't let her leave to go see a doctor when she's sick. She has no sick leave. She has no vacation leave. You know, it's those kinds of circumstances that, for those classes of workers, they actually haven't changed since my great-grandmother, right, in the end of the 19th century, came to the United States.
I mean, how is that the case? I guess, you know, when I think of domestic workers in terms of, you know, I guess it was about, I don't know, I guess about a year ago, was it? Maybe it was a year almost to the day, I think, actually, in Harris v. Quinn, where there was an attempt to really sort of get U.S. domestic workers into some type of collective bargaining position. And the Supreme Court basically thwarted it because of the way that domestic workers are organized and paid through different entities.
Right. No, and that was such a tragic outcome. Although I do have to say, SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has continued to organize home care workers as much as they can. But the issue there was, you know, it seems it was like a win-win situation where these were workers who are paid by Medicaid. And so it's the sort of the circumstance where you have a very poor worker serving a very poor client. And the state administers Medicaid. And so it's from the state that the workers are getting paid, but they were treated as independent contractors. So And the situation was bad for everybody because the state had no idea who the different workers were really. And so there's no quality control, no ability to do training or monitoring of the elderly or disabled population. And the workers were earning a pittance. So the union stepped in and started working with, they did it in California, they did it in Illinois, work with the state to set up a kind of quasi-bargaining relationship. So they would elevate the pay and work protections for the workers. They didn't technically become employees under this circumstance, but were treated as employees more or less. And so they was a dues checkoff. And so there was the National Right to Work Committee came in, and, you know, as they do, as they want to do, whenever there's a good situation for workers, right. They come in to challenge it. And so they said this was a First Amendment violation. They had found a home care worker who didn't want to have any pay dues to the union, and that went up to the Supreme Court. And what the Justice Alito wrote was essentially that they could not be they could not be treated as public employees because they're not only quasi employees. And that sort of summed up to me the sort of dismissive attitude a lot of people have about this category of workers. They're quasi employees. And so they didn't, you know, the Supreme Court said that this situation could not continue. So it's a voluntary membership. It's not typically in public employee, public employees, unless they're in a right to work state, have a dues checkoff to cover the cost of the services that unions provide.
Right, in terms of the negotiations and whatnot, the
exactly,
agency fees.
Otherwise, you have free riders who benefit from, you know, increased wages because they have a union but don't contribute. And that's, you know, economically untenable. But so, you know, that was the real tragedy, was finally you had a circumstance where these really, really low-wage workers, as I said, many of them don't even earn minimum wage, and they certainly don't get paid overtime. You know, finally had the circumstance where they would be able to have a certain limited amount of protection in the workplace, a slight increase in their wages, and that was taken away from them.
And their clients would have the protection of knowing that these people are sort of like in a system and organized and can get have better access to training and whatnot.
Exactly. And there were many clients who actually came out, you know, many during the whole course of the litigation in their wheelchairs you know, otherwise to support the workers. I mean, they're often, you know, they're very close relationships in many cases.
Right.
Where, you know, this mostly there are 90% women. This woman who comes into their house and takes care of them and feeds them is really probably the person they spend the most time with of anyone else. And so I find that very, very disappointing. But I am, I do, you know, see that the workers themselves and the unions continue to organize. Many workers join, even though there is, you know, this problem with the free rider issue now for home care workers. But there have been advances. The other thing that's happened is that, you know, workers, and I think this is really amazing because these are really the low wage workers. There are many of them immigrants. They have been able to push for legislation in a number of states, just most recently Connecticut, protecting domestic workers and giving them same protection as other workers. And they're not asking for anything special. They're just asking not to be left out. They're just asking not to be exploited and not to be sexually harassed with no recourse. I mean, that is really a huge issue for domestic workers that they, you know, they can't, if they're sexually harassed, it's not illegal. They're not protected.
This is the thing that I think people don't really understand is that it's just hard, I think, for people to get their heads around the idea that, like, there are just, you know, presumably on its face, random sectors of our workforce that just don't have the protections that other people have. I mean, I think that's a very, like, conceptually, I think that's a hard thing for people to sort of get their heads around. Well, but it makes sense in the context of this sort of, like, original sin in some regard.
Right. Well, it's sort of, you know, you could also think of it as a template. You know, we created this template and we just use it over and over and we never think about it. And I'm ashamed of myself because when I drafted the Paycheck Fairness Act, I never thought. So in those particular laws from the civil rights era that protect against discrimination, there's a small business exclusion. And I never thought, why is it that small businesses should be allowed to discriminate? Why is that? You know, why do we accept that a company that's smaller than 15 employees can just you know, say, I don't want women, or I don't want minorities, or I don't want gay people. I don't want, you know, I don't want a particular type of person in working for me, and I can discriminate because I'm a small employer. And that's just, I think, fundamentally a question that I have now been asking myself. And you can see it in the data that smaller businesses are less likely to hire minorities, that there's an impact on women. There's certainly lower pay.
What is the justification? What is the ostensible reason why we do it? And what is the sort of the genuine reason?
It's a great question. Well, so there, I wouldn't recommend reading the congressional record generally as a way to unless you want to go to sleep.
That's how I put my kids to sleep.
But in this case, the research was fascinating for me as I was trying to understand this and writing Under the Bus, was, you know, that they're pretty clear again that in members of Congress and saying, you know, it's one thing for you big companies up north, you know, to have mixing of people. But our small businesses are like families. You know, people want to be with the people they want to be with, and they don't want to have forced on them other kinds of people. I mean, it was really very clear. And, you know, Senator Mondale, in the context of the Fair Housing Act, which has what's called a Mrs. Murphy's exemption, which is, I think, should be offensive to the Irish, Irish Americans, assumption that they don't want to rent to people of color. But he talks to me. It's like, why is this? Well, I know what we're saying. I know that this is something I have to swallow so this bill can pass. But what we're basically saying is discrimination is okay. And so that's where it comes from. It's something I didn't really think about. But what we've decided is that, you know, and I think probably in part because at the time, the big companies segregated their departments. And they put women in certain jobs and not others. And that still happens to a great degree. But so you see the legacy of that in all of these civil rights rules. And, you know, to the credit of many states that have been adopting more expansive protections, they have either lowered or eliminated that altogether. Because, again, as a moral issue for us to think about, why should a small business be able to discriminate? And why is that a legitimate thing to do? And so that's really the sort of the history of it. But it does continue, and it continues to. I mean, even the Family and Medical Leave Act is not a discrimination issue exactly, although it certainly affects women and men, people with families. But it only applies to companies with fewer than 50 employees. That's cuts out more around 40% of workers, and so. People who don't have paid leave, you know, for many of the workers who are even covered, about 60% who are covered by the law, a lot of those don't have paid leave. Very few do. We only have 11% of workers with paid leave. But so the ones who are covered by the Family and Medical Leave Act who have the right to unpaid leave, a lot of them can't afford it because it is extraordinarily hard for a person who's not making above a certain amount of money to take time off from work to have a child. So a lot of women take off, you know, just give birth and come right back. And that has all sorts of implications for their health, for their child, for nursing, for the child's health in terms of whether they get vaccinated or not. And so, you know, those are issues that I also think, you know, they're not exactly in the same frame as coming out of an understanding that, you know, that small businesses are allowed to discriminate, say, but are still, you know, have a profound impact on humans, you know, people working in the United States. And how this all kind of ties together, I think, and sort of relates to the broader question of our employment relationships, where I get into the discussion of independent contractors, the increasing use of those designations and temp workers and more part-time workers, is that by using these kind of categories and setting numerical levels of 15 or 50 or 40, 40 is the Affordable Care Act number, employers are really encouraged in some ways to manipulate the titles of employees. Because say you have 41 employees and you're going to be covered by the Affordable Care Act, why not make two of them independent contractors? You know, and you do that, or outsource one department, your HR department or your finance department, outsource that, and all of a sudden you're not covered by the law. And so that happens in all of these cases, and is one of the elements that leads to this increasing, the growth of a contingent workforce, which many people estimate is now about 40 million in the United States, and
well,
40
what?
Million that is highly, you know, is very much female and people of color.
What is the solution to that? I mean, what's the better mechanism? I mean, for instance, you know, this my podcast is a small business. We have parental leave at this, you know, in our podcast here. But what's the best way to do it? Is it based upon, because I can imagine in certain situations where that becomes, you know, prohibitive, cost prohibitive in some situations. But is it a way of like saying, like, if your revenue is X number of dollars, is that the best way to do it?
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's actually how the Fair Labor Standards Act works. That's its kind of trigger for excluding smaller businesses, in addition to also having specific job categories that are excluded. But I actually think there's a, you know, in a more interesting way that has been used in other countries that has been proposed by Senator Gillibrand and is used in a couple of states, which would provide leave through a payroll tax deduction. And so the benefits are that it works more like Social Security. And so the employers don't have to be so burdened, you know, and worry about the cost of, say, having people of childbearing age who might want to take leave, or, you know, if they're a smaller company, feeling like that's hard to fill in when someone's out and they have to pay this, you know, they have to keep them on pay. But in fact, if you had a kind of a payroll deduction and it was also portable, you'd have it work like Social Security, so people wouldn't be tied down. Now, there's an actual productivity issue where younger people who are thinking about having children, women particularly, are loath to tie to move jobs, because right now the Family and Medical Leave Act requires you to be have worked 1,250 hours at your employer for the previous year and for the employer to be of a certain size. So people are afraid to leave because they're afraid that they will not be able to take leave if they take a new job, because they once again have to be back to 1,250 hours and they'll have to work for an employer that's large enough. So this, I think, is very much, and what I, in Under the Bus, I'm very much a proponent of universal plans that are not focused exact on a single company that has to feel like it's trying to balance the books and figure out what kind of employees it's going to have. It doesn't want to have people who are going to cost them more money than others, because they're, but on the other hand, we have a societal obligation to figure out how to enable families to thrive, how to enable women to work. There are a lot of single mothers who have children, and they have to be able to earn enough money to take care of them. And so, you know, it's just something that as a society we have to grapple with, because it's, you know, it's not changing.
So in some respects, it's sort of almost like a sort of these, some of these work share proposals too, right? That we see where through increased either payroll taxes or other mechanisms, you'll have the state sort of making up that fifth day of work or something to that effect, right? So that it becomes a program not unlike childcare or whatnot.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of really interesting and creative solutions. I just think we need to start asking these questions so that we understand that there are consequences. There are, you know, some European countries that, and Canada as well, that have made it such that part-time workers are entitled to the same benefits. Well, yeah, it does a couple of good things. One is it enables people to work part-time if they want to, but two, it means that it's not such an incentive for an employer to create more part-time workers. So in this country, if you have part-time, you know, if you're part-time, you're all of a sudden, you're not, the employer doesn't have to provide you with health care under the Affordable Care Act, you know, if you're fewer than 30 hours, you know, and many companies depend, you know, you have any other benefits also depend on full-time status. And so you saw, especially during the last recession, that there was a big increase in employers cutting the hours of certain workers so that they could stop providing them benefits. So I think there are a lot of things we need to examine about how we've structured those workplace laws, because we can see the perverse incentives that are created to make your business smaller, to avoid the compliance with the law, to outsource, to use independent contractors. There are companies like Nissan in the South, has a plant in Tennessee, where something like 40% of its workers are temps.
Wow.
They hire them through temp agencies, and yet they've worked for Nissan for 15 years. You know, how is that a temp? But it's a way that they're not allowed to join a union. Temps can't join unions. Temps aren't entitled to any of the benefits under the contract. Temps can be fired without any protections.
Are there no regulations on the books that in that instance would address something like that? Or is it that OSHA is too understaffed?
Yes. There's something called misclassification, and the Department of Labor has been trying to attack the problem, but it's so widespread by now, and they're all chronically underfunded, especially on the enforcement side. So, you know, companies get away with it. As I mentioned in the Nissan case, they've used a number of different temp agencies because, you know, every temp agency also wants to stay small because then they're not covered by the law. So they sort of outsource themselves, or they are only so many people, and then they provide the workers on the job site. And this is sort of a commonplace way of breaking down the sort of legal protections. And so, you know, I think one of the issues is, though, that we have a very complicated structure in how we analyze this. And, you know, even in the early 90s, there was an important commission set up by the Labor Secretary and the Secretary of Commerce that examined sort of the modern issues in the workplace. And they agreed that, you know, what we had then and what we still have now are sort of 19th century laws that determine whether someone's an employee or not an employee, and it doesn't reflect at all how people work now, but it does mean that the law is very hard to enforce, and it's very easy for employers to designate someone as a non-employee, a temp, an independent contractor, or whatever other category, and then they're completely wash their hands of any legal obligations.
Yeah, it's all right. Well, I want to bring this back to you've talked about some of the potential opportunities, I guess, for change. I mean, they all seem, in some respects or another. I mean, we just saw President Obama today announce, or at least write that he anticipates announcing in Huffington Post, the threshold in which one becomes ineligible for overtime pay has not been raised, like you say, I think for 30 some odd years now, 40? 40 years. And it seems to be that they're going to at least double it in terms of payment. It's going to make, I don't know how much more, 25% more of workers eligible for overtime pay. The way he's doing this is just through basically rulemaking in the Department of Labor. Are there other things that can happen in this way? I mean, in the event that we do get a Democratic president, let's say, in 2016, 2017, I'm going to presume that, President Cruz or Rubio or Bush or Trump is not going to be interested in this type of thing. But in the event that we get a Democrat, what are other things that they can be done, presuming that at the most the Democrats will have control of the Senate? What can be done, not legislatively, but with the laws that already exist on the books?
Well, you know, it's absolutely. I mean, certainly it's prioritizing certain types of enforcement actions. And I think the misclassification issue is one that, we need to throw more resources at. But in terms of kind of the rulemaking issues, there, you know, another area that is important that I think more could be done with is the expectation of federal contractors that I think can have a spillover effect for quite a number of companies. But having setting higher expectations for what they do. You know, why should we give federal contracts to a company that doesn't pay overtime to most of its employees? Why should we give a government contract to a company that doesn't have paid leave? Or, you know, paid family leave, paid sick leave, doesn't provide vacation days. You know, I think we should be expecting more from our federal contractors. And so that is definitely an area where I think the president has a lot of latitude. And the spillover effects are very, very dramatic, as we see from the discussions around the minimum wage.
Right.
That, you know, if you raise the minimum wage, it's not just the workers making the minimum wage who are affected, but it's also those who make a couple dollars above, because all wages will go up some. And that's true, I think, because the federal contracting, federal contractors are a substantial part of our economy.
They're huge,
that there
right?
Will be a real ripple effect.
I feel like they're number two, maybe, in terms of employers, maybe number one. Is that?
Yeah, there's would be a lot of impact on workers if that's to happen.
Interesting. Caroline Fredrickson, the book is Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Thank you so much for your time today. Genuinely
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
What a pleasure to be on your show. I really appreciate it. It's an incredible service that you provide.
Well, thanks for coming on. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Boop, boop. That dynamic of how we had laws that were written 80 years ago, and where the sort of the blatant exclusion of African Americans and women, just explicit. And I'm going to put on a Southern voice, but I hope Southern people are not offended in any way, but that's who it was. We just can't pay them any money, so I'll sign on as long as I can go back to my friends on the farm and just say, hey, you can still play save labor.
You don't respect our heritage. I don't see how I can get behind this hairy legislation.
We have a cultural identity that is fundamentally part of just having people work for dirt nothing. It's just part of our cultural identity. You sit back, you have mint julep. If you don't have a bunch of poor darkies that you're looking at when you're drinking your mint julep, it's just not the same.
And darkies is putting it politely. But, you know, over there in France, you know, they drink their wine. They have them long lunches and everything. It's same with us. We got them out in the fields working, yeah. Having to be just.
Would you ever tell
down.
Those folks in Paris that you can't have them gondolas going down the rivers everywhere?
I mean, personally, I think it's quite ungodly, but I would never say I can't do it because I respect your cultural way of life. And that's the same you should do for us, Mr. Roosevelt.
So, but the thing is,
excuse me, Mr. President,
Mr. Fake President.
And I don't want your wife in the room when I'm in here either. She makes me uncomfortable.
But then, and then, you know, you've laid the foundation at that point, and then every subsequent labor law or improvement is built upon that foundation. So it is, in many ways, the story of America, right?
Well, like, I would hope is that
we just believe in a free and fair race. Everybody has the same opportunity, except for those people who started off the race with their feet in cement.
Equal opportunity, not equal results. I mean, it's America. But even if one day the darkies can vote and whatnot, hopefully there'll be a whole other groups of people that we're not even considering who will get paid poverty wages, be able to be exploited and harassed. You got to think in the long term.
That's right.
Mr. Roosevelt.
Who knows who it could be? Maybe Martians. They'll come down and we can exploit them.
They're like, yeah, it's a nice spaceship you got there. Now get on the floor and start scrubbing.
There you go. All right.
We're not respectful of the South on this program, clearly.
Well, I'm not. Yeah. We're not mocking the South. We're not mocking like the land.
We're not mocking the South at all. Just your heritage.
It's just we're doing the accent of a guy, a generic plantation owner
/ senator / congressman
/
governor
businessman, right?
Mayor, businessman, newspaper columnist,
Kiwanis Club prize winner.
First of all, Michael's southern accent that he was using right there was some sort of like horror movie backwoods type.
Backwoods. I wasn't. Sam was doing the genteel. I was doing the more of the.
He was doing the guy who works for me and does my dirty work. Folks, JustCoffee.coop offers fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate for your enjoyment. It offers fair wages for those people who work on every part of it. It is a co-op, so it's employee-owned. Coffee's delicious, and the shipping is free. And you get 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. Right now, I am staring, as I speak, at a 2-pound bag of Majority FM coffee, which I can't really enjoy today because the water's been turned off in our office, and so nobody can go to the bathroom. And so we may wrap up things early today, folks.
So it's a little intense in here.
Things are a little bit weird. It's a little bit awkward. We're seeing each other in ways that we never wanted to see. And I'm wearing some adult diapers. I got the idea from
really
my son.
I didn't want you to go there.
Well, you know, every day I come
literally
home.
Saul,
just he doesn't care. He just poops his pants, and I clean it up. And so I figure, why should he get all the fun?
You know, like with little kids, you know, when they do that and they sort of stare at you like, what are you going to do? Sam's been doing that face all day.
That's right.
Because you got those Social Security stats. What are you going to do?
Right. Got a problem? So we've set up a huge changing table in the corner of the office.
I feel like talking to the head of the American Constitution
folks,
Society.
If you're going to buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you're going to buy it from these people already, you might as well give us a kickback. Also, again, reviews on iTunes, very helpful. We were going to do that thing where we read one on the most recent one as a way of encouraging people to leave a review. So I'm going to do that now. I'm pulling it up. Hopefully it's a good one. If it's a bad review, it's going to be a little bit sad. Folks, we have a subreddit now on Reddit, if you're on Reddit. And we're posting the show in a diary, a daily diary on Daily Kos. So if you are on Daily Kos, give us a recommendation. Give us a rec. Push us up the rankings. Leave us a review on iTunes. That helps. It's really sort of shocking how much it helps. We're at 56 right now in the news and politics ratings. Let's see here. And the most recent review. Oh, phew. It's a good one. Oh, this is from yesterday. Well, that's good. Been listening for about a year now after having been suggested to me multiple times. How many times do you have to have it be suggested to you to listen to a podcast, for gosh sakes? Who are the different people who are suggesting?
People have been telling me to listen to this show for years.
That's right.
What a win.
Yes. There you go. Matt still has yet to listen to the program. Often political shows are hard to listen to for long because they tend to be dull and use language that isn't accessible to all. This show utilizes Sam Cedar's humor. That's well, thank you. And intelligence. Well, this is a very well-written review. to create both an informative and interesting podcast. Would suggest. I love it. And you know you don't have to write an extended you don't have to write an extended review. You can write like just a good show. Now
Mrs.
let me read
Cedar's review. There was a great
I'm
going to
read also the most critical review. No, this is from July 21st, 2012. This is the first one that comes up, most critical. Pathetic. That's it. So, all right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. Oh, wait a second. Wait a second. Wait 1 second. And we're going to do this on the free show. And I know we probably should do it up front, but this is a reward for people who listen to the free show all the way through. On the program today, I made a claim that we have parental leave on this program. And now that would be very easy to say if, you know, people are like, well, you only have kids working on your show anyways, little babies like Michael.
It's true. Sammy's running like a sweatshop here with children. 12-year-olds in a bathroom.
This is sort of like emotionally abusive,
however,
self-indulgent sweatshop.
However,
at least
who do you think packed those Kickstarter DVDs?
Yeah, at least those,
exactly.
At least those Chinese sweatshop people don't have the same psychodrama of Sam.
All right. All right, Michael. We've heard from you now. But somebody has an announcement to make.
Michael?
Matt?
I, Matt Binder, will be in the coming weeks, maybe even sooner, a proud father of a young baby boy.
What are you talking about?
A young baby
Wrong
boy.
Sound.
That doesn't make sense. A baby boy. Yes, that's true. Thank you. Thank you.
Pop open the Monster Energy drinks in celebration.
Mom! Mom! Why did you do that to me?
So Matt is having a child, and he of course is going to take some time off to take the child to the 7-Eleven, get its first Slurpee.
Yeah, WWE SummerSlam's around the corner. It's coming to Brooklyn.
Take the kid to wrestling, pro wrestling, and go and he's going to buy him a bunch of Twinkies and. So over the next couple of weeks, things could be a little bit erratic around here. What we're going to do is we're going to take vacation, I'm going to probably go the 10th, and these guys are probably going to go the following week, more or less, because we have told Matt's baby, now this is the way it works, right? Your baby gave us a date. And then we said, okay, fine, we're going to build our vacations around this date. So the baby better show up on time.
Hopefully.
All right.
Hopefully not early before we've prepared for this vacation.
Hope baby hasn't been taking a lesson from his uncle Mike and, just sort of show up when he wants and
he
whatever.
Twists Mike's.
Yeah.
Michael.
Breaks things and.
He'll never do a guest list, that's for sure.
That's right.
Goddamn right. I'm going to teach that kid how to take care of business.
All right, we got to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We will be right back after this, ladies and gentlemen. You can IM me at Majority FM. Pick up the app, Majority app. Call us via the phone. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.
Say to Napoli.